This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Justin Natvig had a flair for performance for most of his life. As a young kid, he used to sneak into his grandparents' attic and dig through his grandmother's things. She had these vintage dresses, hats, wigs, shoes, makeup, the whole thing. And he'd put it all on and play Diana Ross records and lip sync for an audience of one, his own reflection in the mirror. He kept that passion a secret for many years as he continued to explore his own sexual identity within a tumultuous family environment. During a particularly rocky period, right before he dropped out of high school, he happened to stumble on a drag show at a bar in Raleigh and decided that he wanted to be on stages like that one day. Almost two decades later, he holds the title Miss Gay North Carolina under the stage name Vivian Vaughn, making him the state's champion of female impersonation. He hands over the title next week, but first joins me in the studio, Justin Natvig. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Take us back to your childhood. You grew up in upstate New York, right?
Yeah, I'm originally from the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York, and I grew up there in the 80s and early 90s, and actually it was known for... The Catskills was called the Borscht Belt.
Right.
And so basically there were a lot of really large resort hotels with all of these amenities, and people, mostly of the Jewish faith, would come up from New York City, and they would, you know, I believe that they came there because that was a safe haven for them at the time. Mm-hmm. At least that's how it started. And so they could come and stay on one property and see different acts, and they could bring their children with them and do different things. And so by the time I was growing up there, that phase was kind of moving out, and so these hotels were closing down, and it was turning out to be, you know, kind of a remnant of what once mm-hmm. was. But for me, it was kind of cool because I used to sneak into these places and hotels sometimes that look like the hotel in The Shining, you know, and I mean, just gaudy, huge hotels, you know, and my grandparents owned a bungalow colony. And so I would just walk up the street and there was Grossinger's and the Concord and Raleigh. And I would see these different acts being played because back then, if your career was kind of on the downslope mm-hmm. a little bit, you ended up doing the Catskill circuit. So.
But there was still some name acts, names at least that you would recognize.
Oh, sure, yeah. I saw just as a child and, you know, sneaking in and peeking from the back rows, I would see the Smothers Brothers or Aretha Franklin. I've seen, you know, Joan Rivers would come through there sometimes, but I never really saw her. Chubby Checker, things like that.
So you're doing that. The economy is beginning to totter a little bit because obviously these clubs aren't what they used to be. And your family then went through a huge upheaval about when you were like 8 or 9 years old, right?
Yeah, and so around that time, you know, I was living with my my parents, and they were both my parents, and then I had two half brothers who were from my mother's previous marriage, and so around 1990, it was Christmas Eve, and we were getting ready for Mom to come home and clean the house because we knew it would make her happy, and she didn't come home, and so I believe it was in the middle of the night, my dad finally came back, and what had happened was. She had passed out and she was being helicoptered to Westchester Hospital because she had a double cerebral aneurysm burst. Mm. And so basically she never came home after that. And she was in a coma for about 5 weeks and eventually she did come out of that. And so at that point, though, there was no telling how she was going to be. And she had short-term memory loss. So she remembered everything that happened up until that point. But even to this day, which she is with us now to this day, she doesn't remember much about what happened 5 minutes ago. And so the roles were reversed at a very young age. And I very much became her parent, you know, in that time.
Well, tell us about your parents up until that time. What were they doing?
So at that point, my father was running a construction company, and he was working really hard. And for whatever issues between the two of them, they had decided to get divorced. But it was just on paper, and nobody even knew it. We didn't know it. And so when that happened, then there was this question of, well, what's going to happen to the children and the home and everything? And he had put everything into her name, so suddenly he didn't own anything, you know what I mean? And so at that point, you know, there was a custody battle and, you know, choose who you want to be with and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I ended up with my dad, and my brothers ended up staying in the house, and they would have a guardian who was my aunt, and she would overlook whatever they needed as they kind of came out of their teenage years. And my father and I moved into with my grandparents at the time.
So then you were essentially living with your grandparents and your father. They were all in the same house.
Right. You know, he was busy a lot. And so I spent a lot of time over there with them. And they had a pretty heavy hand in raising me. You know, prior to that, growing up, I was there every weekend anyway, because, you know, they had this bungalow colony and all these kids would come up for the summer. And I had a lot of fun. And, you know, I think my parents enjoyed a break, and whatever they were doing on the weekends was whatever they were doing. So,
right.
You know.
Right, it's good to get away from both of you. So that's where you discovered your grandmother's attic. Tell us about that. What was that?
It is. And so, yeah, you know, I spent a whole lot of time there. And, you know, the summers I speak of were only summers. So all winter long, I was pretty much alone there with them. And my room had this attic off of the room. And there was a skeleton key that I found. And, you know, I was a very nosy child. And so I found that skeleton key, and I went in there and I found just all sorts of neat stuff, because my grandmother never threw anything away. And so there was just, it was the clothes, vintage clothes and nails, and there was a record player and this like boudoir. And so I just pulled all this stuff out and made that my room. And at night I would lock the room and I would put all these things on and I would play these records. You know, Diana Ross, Ain't No Mountain High Enough was my favorite number. And I had no idea what I was doing. And God forbid anyone ever found out, I would just be absolutely mortified. You know, it was a huge secret for me, but I loved it, and I didn't know why. And, you know, as an adult looking back, sometimes I wonder, was I kind of like replacing, you know, because my mother now wasn't around anymore, and was I kind of embodying that female role in my life? But, you know, that's just a thought.
Well, especially at that age, there are a lot of reasons why a kid would want to dress up and do a performance like that.
Sure.
At the same time, when did you begin exploring your sexual identity?
And so, and see, I've always known that I was different. And so, and the way I describe that to people is that I went through the same processes that a straight person goes through about the opposite sex. You know, when you're young, you don't like them, and then, you know, you're a little curious, but you don't admit it, and you know, all the phases. Yeah. I went through all those same phases, but with the same sex, and so I'm very sure that this is very natural to me. You know, there was nothing that happened that occurred that. And so, you know, at that point, though, I was really, you know, now I'm 12, 13 years old, and I'm really starting to understand that, you know, this is what was going on, and I was gay. And so, and in that time, my father was preparing, he was getting ready to remarry. And so this was someone I did not know very well, and she had a little daughter, and who was younger than me. And so they decided after they got married that they were going to move to North Carolina. And for me, it was kicking and screaming. That was the only way I was going to come down here, because, you know, my mom was nearby, and my grandparents, they had, you know, they were my life, basically. They had done so much for me, and that was home, you know, so I didn't really know a lot. And I think I had a whole lot of anger going on at that time, and I didn't even realize it.
What was your relationship like? How was that evolving after your mother's accident and while you were living with your grandmother?
Between myself and my
father? And your father, yeah.
Well, you know, he's changed a lot. My father is very calm now, and we actually have a very good relationship now. But at that time, I think he was going through a lot, and there was a whole lot of pressure on him. And, you know, and so he wasn't always around when I was with my grandparents. And when he did come around, it was a very authoritative experience. And so I think respect was more important than compassion a lot of times. And not that there wasn't any compassion, there was, you know what I mean? And so, but tensions were absolutely building. And I think I had a lot of resentment, because as a child, you expect everything from your parents. And when you end up with just one, you expect double from that parent, you know? And so I was already, you know, feeling resentment towards him in some way. And so him moving me to North Carolina really, I think, pushed that over the edge.
Where in North Carolina did you start?
We ended up in North Raleigh. And at that point, you know, it was, I was going to go to high school and found out that I ended up having to go to middle school because in New York, you could miss a grade, and I did miss a grade in New York from one class, and you would be moved on to the next level. And here, that did not happen. So I moved here, and that was my immediate discovery.
So then you're in a brand new place. Mm-hmm. You're in that awful middle school universe, and now you're actually kind of one grade behind.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and that's me, you know, here in a place that I did not know anybody, and I came up with every idea that you could come up with as to why I should move back and live with my grandparents. I mean, that's all I was thinking about the whole time.
So. You may have thought about it, but it didn't hold, and you did stay. Justin Natvig is my guest, known better by his stage name, Vivian Vaughn, the current Miss Gay North Carolina, and we will continue our conversation with him in just a moment. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest today, Justin Natvig. He is also known by his stage name, Vivian Vaughn, and is the current Miss Gay North Carolina. He hands over the title next week, but he's with me today to talk about how he got to this point and of course, all about the world of the pageant. But first of all, we just got you moved to North Carolina. It was something you didn't want to do. You met a friend named Heather, and she grew to be very important to you. Tell us about Heather.
So in that time, I was very kind of to myself. I tried to make some friends locally, and I think word got out that I was gay, and within that time, I was beaten up a few times.
You're in middle school now, right?
Middle school into high school over this, you know, year or two period of time.
Got
and
it.
So, you know, and it was very tough. And I, you know, people suspected it. I was not out, you know, at the time. And then I was actually sort of dating this girl, and we would all of our friends would hang out over at her house. And this girl, Heather, shows up. And so I'm sitting there, you know, minding my business, whatever. And I got up and left the room. And she said to everybody, "That boy is gay." And they were like, "No," you know, and she said, "Give me 2 weeks." And so she was, you know, I didn't even know about this, obviously, until later. But in 2 weeks' time, she befriended me. And I'm sure there was no ticking clock or anything. But, you know, she befriended me. And she was so fun. I mean, she was a lot of fun. And we just became very close. And she had a very similar effect on me that she had had on basically everyone she met. She was just instantly friends with everybody, you know. And so she convinced me, you know, that what I was nothing to hide and nothing to be ashamed of, and, you know, certainly nothing wrong, and that I should embrace it and celebrate it. And, you know, at that age, during that time, it was unusual. I mean, nowadays kids are coming out much earlier, and I think that's fantastic as long as it's a healthy thing for them, you know. But at that time, it was quite unusual. And so here I was still going to high school and dealing with a lot of things that came with that. But I had this friend, and she convinced me of all, you know, she just saw who I was, you know. And I think throughout my life, that's always been the one thing, even to this day, that I struggle with, is finding people who just simply see me clearly, you know. And so we ended up becoming friends for a long time. And she was beside me through a lot of the things that happened coming up, and so eventually, should I get to that?
Well, point? I'm just gonna. She seems precocious in the sense, and really gifted in so many ways. Because that "give me 2 weeks" could be some kind of an adolescent power trip, but it wasn't. It was clearly an effort at some point to help guide you to some level of comfort.
So she became very vital for me, and she actually introduced me to her best friend, who, you know, he was gay, and so right away we decided we should be boyfriends, and, you know, and that didn't last very long, and now we're still friends, and we look back on that and laugh because we were kids, you know what I mean? And he was the one who took me to CC's for the first time, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was a bar in Raleigh, and I was 16 years old now at this time, and I had never been to a place like this before.
And what kind of a place was it?
It was, well, for me, it was a gay bar, you know, but I had never been to a gay bar before, and I had seen many bars by then, but not a gay bar. And so I was sneaking out at night and going with him down to downtown, and the first time I stepped in there, there was a drag show going on, and I was just floored by it completely, because not first it was other people do this, and then it was they do it in front of other people, and then it was, you know, they're good at it, you know what I mean? I was completely blown away, and I knew I wanted to do that because I knew that that's what I did, that was me, you know, and people were celebrating it, and it was really a big deal. I mean, when the show began in the bar, everybody stopped what they were doing and they went over to where that was going on and they watched it and they tipped and they applauded and it was the event of the night, you know? Yeah. And so I very quickly fell in love with that. And so with all of these resentments going on inside of me, you know, with family and I just was struggling with my identity and all of this, there was this little piece of my life that was exciting and it was fun and it was real, it was true, you know? And so it really made me start to look at the other things and resent them even more, you know? And so I would...
What other things? What do you mean?
Well, and the home life was a big thing for me at the time.
Were you out at home by this time?
I couldn't be, no. Yeah. And I think they were starting to figure it out, my dad and his wife at the time. And, you know, I recently, just the other night, reconnected with her daughter just two nights ago. And we haven't seen each other in 20 years because they've been divorced now. And, you know, and it makes me think, like, she was probably such a wonderful lady, but I did not know that because of the, you know, how we were brought together, you know. And so, but my dad really did not want, he didn't want his son to be gay, and most parents don't, at least at first. And he had this idea of coming to North Carolina and, you know, hell or high water, we were going to be a family. And, you know, and I think that that objective was so strong that some things may have gotten overlooked. And so we were having some trouble, and we were arguing a whole lot, and he was prying into my life because he was trying to figure out what was going on, and it became very hectic between the two of us.
Well, he found out.
He did find out, yeah.
Tell us about that.
And so...
How did he find out?
Well, you know, and after a little while, I mean, I wasn't really keeping my secret very well, you know, and so that was part of it, you know. And he did find out, and we never really had this whole I'm coming out conversation, you know, it was more he knew and I was still sneaking off, and occasionally I'd be dating someone or something and I'd bring them into the house and sneak them in at night and we would be, you know, sitting in my room laughing or something and he'd hear it, wake up and chase them out of the house, you know, and so it just, but it built tensions. And during this time I also started, I was skipping school because, you know, I just, everything felt like prison to me if I wasn't just someplace where I could be me, you know? And so that was creating an anger for him. And I got in trouble in school. And so, you know, we were kids smoking a little pot and we were back in the woods behind school and we should not have been doing that. And we got caught. And so they made us go to this class that you go to in the evenings. And everybody's parents sit around and they all talk about how terrible their kids are. So the parents feel supported that, you know, and we didn't really get anything out of it, you know. And so, but, you know, my dad got, he got the idea that, and I think, you know, again, it was a matter of respect, control, and authority, that kind of thing. And so he had this, he wrote up this schedule. This was going to be my life. I was going to wake up at this time. I was going to do these things. I mean, this is when I, you know, I mean, from morning till night. There was no fun in there. And, you know, prior to this, I was never really encouraged much to go out and have fun late nights. If we were going to see a movie that would go on till 11:30, I had to stay home. I mean, it was very strict. And here I was trying desperately to make friends. And most of those people were beating me up. You know what I mean? And so, you know,
eventually you had to move out of that.
Yeah. So I had to leave, you know, and that did not go well. And I ran away, basically. And also at the same time, I had to drop out of school.
So that's it. You've dropped out of high school. You've run away from home. Where were you living? What was going on at that point? How old were you?
So at that point, I'm like 16, and now I'm pretty much out, you know, other than to other areas of my family. And so the first thing I did was I was dating someone at the time, and he lived out in Middlesex, kind of way out middle of nowhere towards Wilson. And his mother let me stay there a lot, and she didn't quite understand what was going on because we didn't really tell her. But I stayed there. I stayed just about any place where somebody would have me. And sometimes that meant sleeping in a closet or on a couch or whatever. And a lot of times that brought on people who had interests in me that were not healthy and they were not well-founded. And so there was one person that I was staying with for a while. And I mean, everybody joked this was my sugar daddy or something because he would do things for me, but he never acted inappropriately until one day I found his diary, and I should not have read his diary, but I was a teenager and you couldn't tell me no. And he was in love with me, and it was a very disturbing experience to find. And eventually I left that situation and moved on to other places. And then I ended up in a house where we partied a lot, and it was the party house, and everybody went there all the time, and there was a lot of drug use and stuff going on there, and at that age, I should not have been there, and I know that, and, you know, but the people were wonderful people, you know what I mean, and I still keep in touch with them, but we just were not good for each other at the time. And then during that time, we got robbed. And so a bunch of folks came in the house in the middle of the night and tied us up and pistol whipped us and beat us, shoved a gun down my throat and said, "This is what you get for being a fag," you know. And I mean, it was a horrible, horrible experience. And during those years as well, it wasn't people I was staying with, but people who were showing an interest in trying to be nice to me. And in that time, I was actually raped twice. And so there was a lot of trauma going on. And so by then, we're getting to a point where I've still been friends with Heather this whole time. And I was starting to see someone that I really liked, and we were falling in love, and we were just very young, you know. And he, I guess I didn't know as much about him as I thought, and about his personal life and his family life, and he ended up shooting himself in the head. He committed suicide, and that was the first person I think I was really, like, in love with, you know what I mean? And so after that, I was really torn apart, and Heather was, you know, we called her Hef, and she was my best friend, and so I was turning to her for that support. And in that time, it was just within a couple of months, I had to go to Florida. I had not seen family, cousins that I was separated from when I moved to North Carolina, you know, from my mother's side of the family in years. And one of them was getting married, and oh my gosh, I'm going to see these people, and so I'm nervous, you know. And one distant cousin who I still am not, I've never been very close with, she outed me. She figured it out, and she outed me at my cousin's wedding. So the entire that side of the family found out at one time, and you know, it was a horrible, horrible experience for me. So I'm at the reception. I'm mortified. I just want to hide under a rock. They're all looking at me. Not all of them. Some of them were very supportive, and you know. And so then I get a phone call, and I need to get back to North Carolina because my best friend Heather had died in a car accident. Oh, and so I'm mourning over, you know, my partner, who had passed, and now I'm mortified about this, and now my best friend had just died, so I have to come back here. And so I wore the same suit to my cousin's wedding that I wore to my best friend's funeral the next day. And so that began a whole lot of a really dark place in my life. And so as a group of friends, we came together, but some of us split apart. And, you know, and I grew really close with the girl that was dating her, you know, in high school. And she was suffering from a lot of mental illness, and she was not doing very well with this. And we remained friends for a few years. And so in that time, I ended up realizing that Raleigh was just not a good place for me. And so I needed to go to Greenville, North Carolina. I had a friend down there, and she said, you know, it's not drugs. It's very, you know, and so, and I got in trouble with the law. I was in Wilmington and I got a DUI and, you know, it's just, this had gone on for long enough, you know? And so I needed to do something. So it's funny that I joke because I went to Greenville to get myself together. And most people I met in Greenville, they say, well, this is, we usually leave here to get ourselves together.
So there's plenty of space, at least for somebody who wants to get it together. Well, at that point in your life, having all of that grief now, bearing all of that, what did it mean to you to get it together? Was there a picture of what you would look like if you were together and where you might take that?
Well, you know, my dad actually drove me to Greenville. And so, you know, a long time we didn't speak, and then we had a rocky relationship, but he wanted me to be okay, you know, and he drove me down there. And I remember saying, he said, what's your plan? And I said, this is a stepping stone for me. I just know it. It turned out to be a 7-year stepping stone. Mm-hmm. But the idea was just start someplace, get a job, keep the job, you know, maybe get your GED, and still put that off for a couple of years. And I was scared of it, really. And so, but eventually I did. I got the GED, and it was easy. Like, all this time I was scared, and no, it was very easy. And they guide you through it so well that, you know, you're not going to fail, you know, you're going to succeed. And after that.
Where in all of this, you developed an interest in drag. You said, oh, I can do that in this bar in Raleigh. What's happened to all of that in the meantime? And was it resurrected in Greenville?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And so in Raleigh, I did my first show in 1998, I believe. And I had no business in drag. And by the time I ended up in Greenville, I still had no business in drag. And so, but you couldn't stop me from doing it, you know. And there, I wasn't alone. There was a group of us, and it was the younger generation. You know, coming up, and nobody was really helping us. And a lot of people have a drag mother who somebody spots you and they show you the ropes and all of that. And I never had anyone to show me anything. So I would go watch these shows and just stare at them. And now you could go to YouTube and tutorials and all this stuff, but you had to memorize and go home and use this drugstore makeup that you bought and try to, you know, mimic that on your own face. And so I made a mess out of my face a million times. And so finally, I started getting it together a little bit, and in Greenville, and I always wanted to be a part of, from the very beginning, I looked at this title, Miss Gay North Carolina, America, because there are different systems, but this is the America system. And so, and to me and to many others, it's the most coveted title in our state. And I set my sights on that. Never did I truly think I would ever get to that point, at least at that time. But I entered my first pageant in Greenville, and I got first alternate in that pageant, which made me eligible to go to my first Miss North Carolina America pageant in 2004. And there were 14 contestants, and I placed 13th out of 14th.
Okay. So you got to start somewhere.
I was like, well, that's a sign, you know.
When did Vivian Vaughn come to life? When did that?
And that was in Greenville as well. Yeah. You know, I fooled around with some very silly names, and then I really wanted to come up with something that was classic, old school, Hollywood kind of thing, which is very much encouraged that type of drag, you know, and what we do. And so, yeah, I played around with a bunch of names, and that's what I came up with. And so she was kind of birthed in Greenville, or at least dubbed a name at that point. And so I continued to perform locally there for a while I was working on school and getting myself together.
And what we can infer from what you said earlier about you had no business being in drag and all the kind of what a mess you made of your face, there is a lot to it. Getting this right is not easy.
No, it's not. And I had to teach myself basically everything. And, you know, as I've grown up, I've realized I should have reached out for help because a lot of people were willing to help me. I just thought that someone should come and help me, but they did not, you know. And so I taught myself my makeup, and I taught myself how to, you know, I watched others. I idolized people in our local community, Kirby Colby and Dana St. James. And I just wanted to be exactly like those people. And, you know, Felicia Powers, these people were very big to me. And so I modeled myself after them.
And there's a performance side of this that we're talking about now, but there's a business side too, right? I mean, you got to get the gig, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in the beginning, you're just getting these $30 gigs. You do one number, you know, and you think you're having a career. And so, you know, over time, I've actually had to treat this like a business. And so I have a separate bank account for that. And now that I make my own hair, I make hair for other people and I sell that. Any profit or expense comes in and out of that, and so that way I can be sure that Justin is not spending money to do drag. You know what I mean? Oh, yeah. Vivian is self-sufficient.
Vivian's got her own account and her own persona. In the meantime, you're going to school as well, right?
Yeah, and so at that point, yeah, I was at Pitt Community College, and they convinced me to get my associate's degree, and so I did, and I'm working three jobs now. I was now determined, you know what I mean? So I never slept. I was working three jobs, and I was, you know, trying so hard to, you know, I didn't even really know where I was going. I just knew if I do these things, they're better than what I've been doing, you know what I mean? And so that's what I did, and all the while working on my drag. And so, as I was finishing my associate's degree, they said, well, you know, you could apply to a four-year college and transfer in as a junior. I mean, they were really great about talking to me about these things, you know, and so I did. And so I was waiting on that, and I was working, you know, and doing everything. And in that time, my friend, who was Heather's partner, who was close to me and all that time, she ended up in prison, and she ended up hanging herself in prison. And so that really trumped me really bad. And so, I was just dealing with all sorts of inside pressure, but I knew that I was not happy where I was. I was in a relationship that he was a wonderful person, and so was I, but we were at the wrong place in our lives, you know. So.
That would bring you to Chapel Hill and UNC, and we will talk more about that when my conversation with Justin Natvig continues. He is also known by his stage name, Vivian Vaughn, the current Miss Gay North Carolina. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Justin Natvig is my guest. He performs under the stage name Vivian Vaughn and is the current Miss Gay North Carolina America. So we talked about the fact you transferred then from community college, Pitt Community College, to UNC Chapel Hill.
I did, yeah. And I'll never forget feeling pretty low in those times. And I was exhausted. And I went out to the mailbox in Greenville, and there was that letter from UNC. And I just was sure that it was a rejection letter. And I opened it up, and I had been accepted. And I stood there just kind of crying. But there was no doubt. I mean, I got accepted to other universities, but I wanted to go to Carolina so bad. And I did. And so I ended up moving to Chapel Hill, and which was an amazing experience. I fell in love with Chapel Hill immediately.
I mean, why? Because given the fact that, A, you didn't want to come down here from the Catskills, then you had to get out of Raleigh because of how things were. Now you're dying to get back. Why?
Well, for me, Chapel, I love the small town effect, first of all. I'm from upstate New York. I like there being a wooded area. I know that's a random thought, but I do like that. And just people were really friendly to me in Chapel Hill. And, you know, for the most part, I was able to be myself. But it's ironic in a way because I didn't know that at first. So I came here and decided I was not a drag queen. And I packed all that up and was not going to do that for a while. And some of the kids on campus, part of the local organization, they found out who I was. And they decided that I should help them run their semesterly drag shows. And so the first time I ever performed in one of those, I wore this huge pink hair, and the next day I was walking around campus and I saw the Daily Tar Heel, and there was this big pink square in the corner, and I was like, it couldn't be, you know, and it was me on the front of the Daily Tar Heel. And so then I collected one every time I passed one all day long to see how many I got, and I got like 7 or 8, so it was great.
Well, it's interesting you talk about this again. This is a profession. People want you to get the drag pageant going on UNC. Give us a bit of the history, because really in some ways you entered the scene at the end of an era in some ways, right?
I did, yeah. And it's important to mention that UNC, the last, I think, tragedy that happened to me was at the end of my first year there, and my brother had passed away as well. And he was in Barcelona, and my family and I had to work to get him home. And so that kind of threw a lot into the mix as well. And so at that point, he was very supportive of me and my dragon. So at that point, I decided I really needed to live my life and do what I wanted to do. And I always wanted to be Miss North Carolina. And so I go back to the beginning now and I think about, you know, I was 16. I was young in those bars. And I did see the end of an era, I do believe, because drag was just a little different back then. And it was more underground. It wasn't really seen on television. And a lot of people didn't even know it was existing in their town. And so when you would go out to see a show, there was this level, there's still excitement, but there was this, you know, this culture built around it that was so intense, you know, and I just wanted to be a part of it. And when you held a state title, like it was a huge deal, which again, it still is. It's just the things have changed a lot. And with technology, a lot of that has come.
What about those things like RuPaul and his TV show? That must have had an impact, right?
It has had an impact, and I think it's a wonderful thing that RuPaul has he started just the same way the rest of us did, you know, and he's managed to monopolize on a lot of aspects of this and to become very commercial about it, and it has increased an awareness in the general community about what this is. I'm a pageant queen, and so for me, we have a very specific way that we like to do drag. We like to be polished, and there should be nails and padding, and you know, you should really look very nice and clean. And so a lot of the things that you see on that are maybe more creative is how I'll put that. So it's changed it, and yes, and when you come out, you know, now a lot of times your crowd reflects that. People tend to expect you to act in ways that you don't want to act. I mean, you know, you used to come and get with the program when you were watching a show, and now they expect you to get to their program sometimes.
Let's talk a little bit more about expectations. The title is Miss Gay North Carolina America. Miss Gay North Carolina America. You're talking about cross-dressing. You're talking about drag.
Yes.
There's a way in which, you know, that conflating those two things can be problematic. I mean, tell us about the varieties of people who are and are not interested in gender and in cross-dressing, for instance.
The Miss Gay North Carolina America is part of the Miss Gay America pageantry system, which is the oldest system of drag that still exists. It's the longest running. And it's modeled after the Miss America, the actual Miss America system. And so we have five categories, but the premise is that you are a man and you don't have any body work done, and we want to see a young professional man bring on the illusion of a woman and also be able to entertain and speak well and represent our system very well. And so you compete in male interview and an evening gown, and you have two different types of talent that you compete in. And so this is just to get a well-rounded view of what you are. In the general community, like the drag community, there are all sorts of folks. You do have trans people who have transitioned, and they want to have a life like anybody else. They don't want to be in drag and perform. And then you have trans folks who I've always been a part of drag, but now, you know, and they're very different because, you know, during the day they look like, you know, whatever gender they want, they identify as. And in the evening they do the same thing we do, you know, they go into the high drag and put on a show. So
it's just the confusion. I mean, if you think about the confusion in our General Assembly, it's just a sort of a not very deep understanding about the continuum of gender identity to begin with. And then, you know, you don't want to advance that any further by saying, well, to be gay is to enjoy cross-dressing. There's a lot of people who are
absolutely
gay who are not interested. There are a lot of straight men who are very interested in cross-dressing. And so just to sort of make clear that gay and cross-dressing or gay and drag aren't the same thing.
No, they are not the same thing. The way that I describe that is many cultures have a certain type of music that they like, or they have a certain type of art or whatever it may be. drag is that for our culture, you know, is one of those things for our culture. And so not everybody in a specific culture with music plays that music, you know what I mean? And so, and here, not everybody does drag. You go out to the clubs, and generally, when we're performing, there may be five of us there in drag, and everybody else is not. And we have very open environments. I mean, we have many, many straight people in our clubs. I mean, we are open to everybody, you know, who just wants to come and have a peaceful experience. And so,
so what's your life like? What do you do as Miss Gay North Carolina America in your year as reigning queen?
Well, I have, first I had to go to Miss Gay America, which I say had to. I mean, that was an amazing experience, and it was a learning experience. I did not place in the top 10 this year, but I was exhausted by the time I had put everything I had into Miss North Carolina. And then after that, you come back and you represent your title throughout the year, and you can define that in many ways, but you're really just required to have prelims, city prelims, and you sell those prelims, and you assist in having people who want your title to compete on the city level and then move up to the state level. I have chosen to do a lot of other things than that with my year.
And also, you're encouraged to have a platform, right? Tell us about yours.
Yes, I actually happen to be part of the Crepe Myrtle Festival, which is the oldest nonprofit in North Carolina and one of the oldest in the nation to benefit HIV and AIDS. And that was something I was doing prior to winning Miss North Carolina. And so I am now the rising chair of the organization, which means that I will oversee 25 people this year, as I assisted doing in the previous year. And so we aim to raise $100,000 every year, and we give that to, we cover our expenses, it's all volunteer, and we give that to beneficiary organizations across the state, and they work directly with people with HIV and AIDS. We do reserve 15% of that to use for maybe legal matters, so we fund things like Equality North Carolina for lobbying efforts and things like that as well.
You have also been able to meet some very interesting people, like the first ever Miss Gay North Carolina America. Tell us
yes,
about that.
Yes, Brandi Alexander. So we had met a couple of times, but Brandi was passing away this year, and it was during my reign, and I thought, you know, I have to go, you know. And so I went down, and I saw her in her hospice, but right before she passed away, and I had these rings made, and they're all identical, and I have one, and every person who won one of my prelims this year was going to get one of these rings, and I wanted Brandi to have one. And when I got there, scared she wouldn't know who I was, she started crying, and she said, "I was waiting for you, Miss North Carolina." And we hugged, and we cried, and we held hands, and I gave her that ring, and 4 days later, she did pass, and she had that ring with her, and we got to share that very special moment, and it's probably one of the most golden things that I've had this year.
You know, you talked about some of the questions and the issues that you talk about in your year as the reigning queen. And I know the past few months have been especially tumultuous time for LGBT individuals in the United States, certainly in North Carolina. You'd been to Club Pulse. You're connected with a lot of people in that community. Tell us about the impact that had on you personally.
Well, you know, first of all, none of my family has ever seen me do drag. And just a couple of weeks before that happened at Pulse, I went down to Fort Myers, where there happened to be a shooting recently, and performed for my cousins for the first time. And what an amazing experience that was to have that support. And it makes me think, you know, these places allow us to just be what we want to be. We're not trying to hurt anybody or anything. And some part of us has been kind of pushed into these places, you know, but there's nothing going on there that isn't going on in any other bar, you know. And so I saw our community coming together. And I saw a lot of people saying we should stop tearing each other down. And, you know, and I say, you know, every community has the negative and the positive, and we just need to focus on the positive because it is here and we do have that. And there's a lot of love and support and friendship and community going on. And I think this only brought us closer together. It was tough because, you know, I'm still nervous. I go into these places, you know, and I do what I do because it's my passion and this is where I can be myself. And you never know. I mean, and many of us are like, when we go into a new place, looking for, okay, how do we get out of here if we have to? So it's been a very scary thing.
What are your reflections on HB2?
Oh, I have many reflections on HB2. I think basically I just go down to some of the bare aspects of it. First of all, nobody I know who is trans or even gay, you know, we're not being ourselves at any cost to anybody else. We don't want anybody else to have to go out of their way in any way to help us necessarily. We can pave our own way. Thank you. You know, we just won't want, we ask that you don't go out of your way to keep us down, you know. And I know a lot of trans people, and I am not trans. I'm a young man, and I can't speak as if I am trans, but what they have had to go through, and I've heard stories of people just, you know, cornering them in restrooms and screaming at them, and, you know, and just this attention, even if they haven't had that negative experience, is horrible. I mean, I think that there are politicians who decided to use the LGBT community as a political pawn because they have it. We're a vulnerable community, and we tend to raise a lot of emotion about, from other people. And in doing so, for their own political reasons, I think that they've been reckless with a lot of lives, and they've been painting this picture of us as predatory and repulsive, and painted with bathrooms, you know what I mean? And I just think that that's really low thing to do. And, we've come this far and we're going to get past this, you know, absolutely. But it just kind of, I almost don't believe that in 2016 we are having this experience.
You've come very far and gotten past a lot. As you look back and think about maybe some of the darkest moments of your life when you were perhaps in some of the deepest wells you were in, and you look back over that period, how do you reflect on that and where you are right now?
Well, I look back and, you know, there were a lot of times I thought about ending my life, and there were a lot of times that I didn't see any purpose for being around, and it was a really tough thing. And now I'm so glad and thankful for the people and the organizations that I've been a part of all these years, because they gave me structure. And I realized at some point it's like, end this or make something out of it, you know? And so I dreamed of some things, and suddenly all of those things have happened. And now I have to figure out what to dream for next, which, you know.
Well, what is the next dream? In terms of Vivian Vaughn, where does she go now?
Vivian Vaughn is going to take some time off so that Justin can spend a little time with himself and just a little bit of R&R and self-care. And then after that, I think she's going back to Miss America, and she's going to do what she's got to do to win that pageant. A lot of folks are trying to encourage me to do it this year, and I know better. I'm not going back till I could do better than I did last time, and nobody knows that except for you. So,
what do you do? I mean, what kind of work and preparation? How much time does it take for you to get ready for a pageant like that?
Usually a year. Yeah, probably a year, and you're going to spend a lot of money, and you're going to raise funds, and you're going to do a lot of practicing and rehearsing and having, you know, attire made and things like that. So it takes a long time.
Do you make your own? Because you do make wigs, right?
I make hair, and I do my own makeup, but if you want to see me have a temper tantrum, you put me in front of a sewing machine, so I pay to have stuff made.
I'm talking to Justin Natvig. He performs under the name Vivian Vaughn and is the current Miss Gay North Carolina America, and you can find out more about that pageant, about Justin, and about Vivian at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Sheldon Ormond. Robin Copley is the technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.